You know, I was laughing a little bit as I was getting ready to teach the lesson about trying to introduce the topic about our country is so polarized right now. If you say, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, there are immediately labels and all kinds of polarizations that's going on. I do smile from time to time when someone on the far right, and I used to laugh and say I was to the right of Genghis Khan with my political persuasions, but I don't think I'm quite as far out as some. But I do laugh when somebody says, well, isn't it great that we live in a democracy, one man, one vote? Well, that's kind of true. Do you elect the President of the United States? No, you do not. The Electoral College elects the President of the United States. You certainly impact that by the popular vote. But how about, are we primarily a democracy as a form of government? We are not. We're a republic. You have one vote. You vote for your representatives, and those representatives then rule and reign. You choose your state representatives, your federal representatives, your state senators, your federal senators. But it really is not a democracy in the purest sense of that term. When we get into this section of the Bible, we're into an ocracy, but it's not a democracy. It's a theocracy. We've left behind the first five books, which we've called the Law or the Pentateuch, and now we're entering into the next section, the historical books. And there are 12 of them. And the very first section of those 12 is something called a theocracy or the theocratic books. If you looked at all 12 of them, they kind of drop into three categories. Some are theocratic, some are monarchical, and some are restoral or restoration books. The theocratic books, the ones we're going to look at today, Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, literally means that ruling and reigning was God. God with theo, Greek word for God, theocracy. God is the one who's ruling and reigning. When we get to the monarchies or the monarchical books, we have a monarch, we have a king. And in those books, we have really kings of the United Kingdom, which we will look at, and then kings of the divided kingdom. But still kings ruling and reigning. Reigning, yes, that's who. Reigning would be better. And then lastly, the books, when they are returning from captivity during the restoration period, you've got three books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. So the first little section that we're in right now is the Joshua, Judges, and Ruth section, where God is doing the reigning. And I don't see Mrs. Kowarsh, but she was sitting up here in the front and at the end of last week's lesson asked that very important question, why did God choose Israel? And I decided that that would be a good place for us to start today. So let's look back at that verse real quick in Deuteronomy 7. Why is he going to rule and reign over this group of people? Why not another group of people? Deuteronomy 7, and we'll look at verses 7 and 8. Let me back up to Deuteronomy 7, 6. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Gee, why did he choose them? Well, the Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any of the other people, stronger, mightier, prettier, whatever, but because the Lord loved you, and he's keeping the oath which he swore to your forefathers. The Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. The bottom line is, he selected them not for characteristics inherent in them, but because of characteristics inherent in him. He wanted a people. He wanted a people to use as an illustration. He wanted to be able to demonstrate his love, and so he chose Israel. So these books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, they follow on the heels of the storyline. We left off in the end of Deuteronomy with Moses dying. Remember, he gets to sit up on the mountain and look over to the promised land, but he doesn't get to go in. He's anointed a ruler, though, and the ruler is Joshua. And so we're ready to start the book of Joshua, the story of the continuing story, I should say, of Israel as they move on in to the promised land. Now, the books of the theocratic books, they're going to cover not only the conquest of the land, that is, when they get there and they drive out all the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, and all the other eight boys, not only the conquest, but also the time of the actual settlement of Canaan, and then a little bit about what life was like. So Joshua's going to have a lot to do with with the conquest. Then Judges is going to talk about how it was that they were living there. And then Ruth is an example of what it was like to live during the period of the Judges. If you're into chronology, I put down some timelines. Likely somewhere between or around 1405 B.C. all the way through to 1043 B.C. God is ruling Israel directly. Now, who are the author of these three books, Joshua, Judges, and Ruth? Well, there's not as much argument about the authors here. There certainly will be arguments when we get into the prophetic books. The reason is they argue over the authors in the prophetic books because they want to argue for a very late date. They want all the events that are covered in the book to have happened. So it's not foretelling, it's just forthtelling. So if they can get a late date, if they can get the writer to have been really late after the events happened, there's no prophetic element. So when we get into history books, there's not as much argument about it. Pretty much they believe Joshua wrote it with some exceptions. Obviously, after he dies, someone had to do some insertion. Judges, likely either Samuel or someone close to Samuel. And then Ruth, we don't know who actually wrote the book of Ruth, but we know approximately when, because part of David's reign is mentioned in the book, so we know it happens during that time period. So let's focus in on Joshua first, then Judges, and a little bit on Ruth. The book of Joshua is a cool book. If you want a book to study with your children, Joshua is a great book to study, especially if you've got boys. They're into it. It's battle after battle after battle. In fact, there's three major military campaigns in the whole book of Joshua. And I put a little quote in there. It says, through three military campaigns involving more than 39 armies, the people of Israel learn a crucial lesson under Joshua's capable leadership. And you might say, wow, a battle plan, a tactic, a way to whoop them, grind them out, whatever. No, it's victory. But it comes through faith in God and obedience to His words rather than military might or numerical superiority. The verse that popped into my mind when I was writing these notes is in Zechariah chapter 4 and verse number 6, where it says, "Not by might and not by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord." When you face a difficult challenge, let's say the challenge is a financial, the answer is not money, the answer is God. It's not by might, it's not by power, but it's by his spirit, by his word. You face a health problem. It's not the white count, it's God. God supervising the white count, God supervising the healing of bones, God supervising whatever, but the victory is at the hand of the Lord, not at the hand of the size of your army or something of that nature. Key verse for Joshua. Hope you all have this one memorized. Joshua chapter 1 and verse number 8, "Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. You meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful." A lot of discussion in our culture about how to be a success. You want to know how to be successful? You have your nose in the book. If there's difficulties in your family business, get your nose in the book. If there's difficulties in your marriage, get your nose in the book. If they're difficult with kids, get your nose in the book. Because that's where success comes. We prosper when we align ourselves with God's plan. Some timing issues as it relates to this book. It took about a month for them to prepare. Then about 7 years of actual conquest. And then 8 years, the latter part of the book, talks about their settlement. And when we talk about settlement, I'll talk about that just in a minute. I got a couple of nice maps for you today. But I want to just at least acknowledge the three campaigns. And I put a little map in the back on that one. Let's see what page it is. She did these all nice and looks like page 6. If you looked at page 6, find the Salt Sea, also known as the Dead Sea. Find it in the bottom right-hand corner. Okay, so remember Mount Nebo. That's where Moses got to peek over into the Promised Land, but he didn't get to come on in. So then they're going to come in, and as the stories unfold, they're going to attack Jericho first, and then a little town called Ai. See it? Ai? Ai? Well, then they're going to have that first one is called the Central Campaign. Then they're going to have something called the Southern Campaign. So the Central Campaign is going to cover Joshua chapters 6, 7, and 8. The Southern Campaign is going to cover Joshua chapters 9 and 10. And then he goes all the way to the north. And that would be the Northern Campaign covered in Joshua chapters 11 and 12. So if you're into, you know, details, as you study those chapters, you can actually use the map to figure out where they went. Now, a quick observer will say, well, what about all the enemies in between, all the enemies in the central? And although Joshua talks about how they wiped them all out, he's not being literal. He's not saying every single tribe was brought under submission. There were lots of them that they didn't do what they were supposed to do with. They didn't finish the battle. They didn't wipe them out totally. It's kind of like, pick any habit that's not very good. We'll pick smoking just because that's one I don't do and it's fun to pick on somebody else. But anyway, you know, if you say, I'm going to quit smoking, and then you throw the pack away, but you keep, you know, just two in your purse just in case kind of thing. And then, you know, once a week, oh, well, it's just once a week. Eventually, you're going to, you know, cave into the habit again, as it is in every other area of our lives where our habits are sinful. In this particular case, what's going on here is that they were supposed to wipe them all out so they could move in and the theocracy could rule and reign, but they don't. They intermarry. They send their boys off to marry their girls. They offer their girls to their boys, and pretty soon it's a big mess again. So, but there are three major campaigns at the start of the book of Joshua. Let's do an outline of the book of Joshua for a moment, which I think will be helpful to try to see where some of those stories that you know fall into place. In chapters 1, 2, and 3, they're at the River Jordan, and they're ready to come on into the land. Some really cool things that happen. One of the stories you may know is the story of crossing the River Jordan. Now, remember, when they crossed the Red Sea, they traveled in on dry land. Well, they're going to travel in on dry land again. God's going to make a way for them in Joshua chapter 3, where they enter into the promised land across the River Jordan on dry land. And as a matter of fact, they go back and put a memorial up to indicate what God had done in bringing them into the land. And many of you may know that story, so I put it in the first little box there. Once they come into the land of Canaan and they're going to start their conquest, first little place they run into is the city of Jericho. And there's probably not a person in this room that doesn't know the story of Jericho. It happens in chapter 6 of Joshua. It is a powerful story of God doing his work and victory coming at his hand, because it doesn't make any sense. It's not a logical plan. There, you know, the military aspect of this is, you know, scratch your head. It doesn't make sense. March around the city one time a day. Great. What's that doing? Shaking the foundations of the walls. Remember, the walls around a city at this time would have been wide enough to accommodate at least one chariot, and most of them two, side by side. So we're talking about very thick, large walls. They walked around one time a day. On the seventh day, what'd they do? They walked around seven times. So they thought they were seven times the idiots that they were the other 6 days. And God says, now at a certain point, I want you to smash your little gourds together. I want, you know, lamps, whatever, trumpets blowing, lights going on, noise, whatever, and, you know, victory will be yours. Well, again, militarily, that makes absolutely no sense. But in fact, because by faith they did it God's way, what happened? The walls fell down flat. They walked across, not on rubble, but flat. What a story to living your life by faith. Do it God's way. Doesn't make sense, doesn't add up, doesn't pencil out, but at the end of whatever, God shows himself faithful. How many times has that occurred in your life where it just didn't make sense? It wasn't going to happen. There's no way. There's not enough money. It couldn't happen. The relationship's terrible. He'll never speak to me again. 1,000 other circumstances, and God goes on your behalf because you chose to live a life of faith. That's all in the story of the conquest of Jericho. Chapter 7 is a contrasting story. If chapter 6 is all about how to have victory when you live by faith, chapter 7 is the antithesis of that. It's what happens when you don't live by faith. It's the story of Ai. Ai is a story where they were set out with the same criteria of conquest. We're going to wipe them out. Don't take anything for yourself. When we wipe them out, don't take nothing. Don't take any gold goblets or silver goblets. Don't take any belt buckles. Don't take any coins. Don't take anything. Just leave it. So our main man here, Achan, decides to take a few little things. And what happens? The entire nation fails. They are destroyed, not destroyed, but they are defeated in a powerful way. It's a smaller city. It should have been a much easier deal, a less enemy in terms of power and strength, and yet they failed. It's the opposite of the Jericho thing. The Jericho thing, they went along with God. They looked dumb. They didn't look too swift. It was a silly thing. It didn't make much sense. People laughed at them, but they did it God's way, and a tremendous victory. We get to Ai, and they're a little, full of themselves. And one guy decides, just pocket a few little things. Nobody will know. And what happens? They fail. They fail miserably. Then they have to figure it out. Who is the culprit? They identify Achan. Achan fesses up. What do they do to Achan? That's not very nice. You shouldn't do that. I chuckle in this culture about disciplining children of any kind of discipline. We don't want to harm their self-esteem. What did God have the people of Israel do to Achan? They stoned him. Just him? Huh? What's that? I think his family as well. Let me just look. I'm in verse 25, and Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. And they raised over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day. And then the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. God doesn't tolerate disobedience in any fashion. Our culture doesn't believe that, but it is certainly true. So then they go on through the book, some coalitions. They match up with some guys, make some treaties, if you will. By the time you get to chapter 10, I want to go to chapter 10 for a second. They're attacking, five of the kings are attacking Gibeon. And it's quite a little story. If you look at chapter 10, verse number 12, Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day that the Lord delivered him up, the Amorites, before the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, "O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Ajalon." So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves with their enemies. This is the story of the longest day, the day the sun stood still. I tried to find the article and I can't find it, but if I do, I'll bring it next week. There is a very nice scholarly article out of a science journal that talks about once they had the various telescopes and satellites and the ability to do some significant dating that they weren't able to do before we got everything up in the heavens. Once they did and they backtracked it and were backtracking history, they discovered there was a missing day. And it was perplexing the scientific community significantly. And, of course, the answer is God held the sun up here for an entire day so the battle could be won. It's a fascinating article. If I find it, I'll bring it in. That occurs here right in the middle of Joshua. They're about ready then, having defeated all that they're going to defeat, 39 different armies, they're going to actually start settling into the promised land. And there's another little map for you. I think it's page 7 that talks about how they settled the land. And I want to spend a little bit of time on this. So if you'll look at page 7, hopefully that'll be helpful to you. Now, first off, Simeon, Judah, Dan, Reuben, Gad, Benjamin, Asher, Naphtali, Zebulun, Issachar. Who are these dudes? They are the 12 tribes. The 12 tribes are the sons of Jacob. Okay, so race your mind back to the end of Genesis. Joseph goes into Egypt. He brings his brothers with him. At the end of Genesis, Jacob is going to bless his 12 sons. And that occurs in chapter 48, I think it is. If you looked at the 12 tribes of Jacob in Genesis 48-49, on page 8, I went down a bunny trail, so you just have to enjoy my little bunny trail. It was only an hour, and it was fun. But I looked at the 12 tribes, and then I looked at my handy-dandy little map. So put those like side by side to each other, 7 and 8. Oh, you can't because they're stapled. Sorry. Oh, it's on the back. She's saving money front to back. What can I tell you? Okay, well, you'll just have to mentally do it with me. But anyway, I looked at the territorial allotments, the tribal allotments, the territories. And I looked at those, and I said, well, that's very interesting. There are two missing, and there are two extra. So let's spend a moment. That one I figured out pretty quickly. You probably will, too. Who's missing of the 12 sons of Jacob? Joseph and Levi. Levi is an easy understand because they were not getting land. They were the priests. They are going to have little cities in which to live, and their job is to take care of the tabernacle and eventually the temple. They're the priests. The priests are going to come out of the tribe of Levi. They don't get land. They're not farmers. They're priests. They're supposed to take care of the spiritual things. Joseph, however, what happened to his allotment? Two sons, the Jacob's grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay, so I'm good so far. Got all that figured out. That kind of works with the tribal territories. Then I went over to Deuteronomy 33, where Moses blesses the tribes. And I looked the list of the tribes, and it ain't the same ones. Simeon's missing. So I go, okay, what happened to good old Simeon? And then I'll just mess you up some more. If you go to Joshua, where we are now, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19, the tribes that are listed there, of course, Levi is not included, Joseph's not included, Manasseh and Ephraim are, Simeon is in there. Then if you go to Ezekiel's vision of what it's going to be like in future time, Ezekiel 48, you will find that Joseph is missing, same as the first one. But Levi's in there, but no Joseph. And then, if you go to the book of Revelation, chapter 7, when it lists those that are remnant, that are going to appear in heaven, Revelation 7, very interesting, Dan is missing. I had some fun. What's that? And Ephraim. Dan and Ephraim are missing. I can't take the time today to explain all of that, but it is to say this. Simeon, if you look at the map on page 7 now, looks like a gigantic territory. But in truth, Simeon gets assimilated very quickly into Judah and into other territories. It doesn't take them very long. They weren't that large of a tribe in the first place, and it doesn't take them very long to intermix, and they lose their physical homeland, if you will, very quickly. So when you look at some maps that are showing you the distribution of the land when they come in and conquer Canaan, you'll see Simeon's not even mentioned in there. It's gone. And that's why it gets assimilated in. I thought you might like to have some fun. Those of you that are the overachievers can go chase all that down. Still looking at the map on page 7, you'll notice that Manasseh gets a double. Okay, what happens is the River Jordan, see it running down the middle of that map from north to south? It's not really a river. Everywhere I looked at it when I was in Israel, it looked like a little, I don't know, slight stream, a little more of a brook even. It certainly is not a raging river at this time. But anyway, the River Jordan was a boundary, if you will. And the 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh are what they call Transjordan, or on the right-hand side of the River Jordan. And then half of Manasseh is on the other side with the rest of the tribes. So when they come in and they start conquering the land in the book of Joshua, they are allotted a place. Remember, land is everything to an Israelite. It is the homeland. We talked about the year of Jubilee. We were talking about Sabbaths a little while ago. And we said on the 50th year, whoever you might have had to sell your land to or even sell yourself into a slavery, in the year of Jubilee, everything went back to the original owner. This land was to be sacrosanct. The land given to the tribe of Benjamin is to be theirs, period. The land given to Dan is theirs, period. That's why it's so interesting that Simeon gets assimilated and disappears. But this is the land that was theirs. Once they conquered, once the battles were over, once they were in a position to take over and settle, they settled according to the map that you see on page 7. The one other thing to mention out of the book of Joshua is, again, the cities of refuge come up. In chapter 20 of the book of Joshua, they are specified, these six cities of refuge. And then in chapter 21, the Levitical cities, the cities that were given to the tribe of Levite, and there were 48 of them, so they would have a place to live. But they weren't to sink down their roots. They weren't to become farmers. They were men of God. They were to work on the tabernacle and then eventually the temple itself. All right, so the book of Joshua is a story of God's power. It's of God's grace. It's the people's obedience. Because of the obedience, for the most part, God gives them a place to settle. There's the allotment of the land. We end up the book of Joshua on a pretty high note. Things are good to go. And then we get to Judges. One author that I was reading this week said you might entitle the book of Judges the book of failure. And it's true. You go from the high note of the book of Joshua to a series of pretty low notes in the book of Judges. I put a chart in there that kind of contrasted Joshua, the book of Joshua, and the book of Judges. You know, the book of Joshua talks about things like freedom and progress and conquest. The book of Judges is bondage and decline and defeat. You know, the key verses in the book of Joshua, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. Mm-mm, not us. The key verses in Judges, so the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God, and they served the Baals and the Ashtaroths. Baals and Ashtaroths are just idols, false gods. Sin is judged and dealt with in the book of Joshua. Sin is tolerated in the book of Judges. The book of Judges actually covers about 350 years. And again, you and I like to think turn a page and it's the next day, but it's not so. About 350 years of history is covered in the book of Joshua. And that history has seven specific cycles of sin, if you will. Seven times that they go from God's grace to failure to defeat to begging God for deliverance. He brings in a ruler that can get them back on track. He gets them back on track and they start all over again. There are seven times that cycles through those 350 years. And they're cycling really through the oppression of some sort of a foreign ruler. And I put it in the little chart there for you. Yeah, in the early part there are 8 years of oppression by some Mesopotamians. And the deliverer is going to be Othniel. A cool guy, by the way. He's a warrior ruler. In fact, there are 17, if you include Samuel, and Samuel really shows up in 1 Samuel. He starts a little bit in, or at least he is in the same form or same definition as the rest of the judges. If you include Samuel, there are 17 separate judges. The first one is going to be Othniel, and there are going to be two that are what they call warrior rulers. Othniel and Gideon. We know a little bit about Gideon. I'll talk about him in a minute. One is a priest, Eli. It says Elijah here. It's Eli. That's a typo. And then one is the prophet, Samuel himself. Now, if you look at that chart of those seven cycles, if you will, you can see who the enemies are. The Moabites, the Philistines, the Canaanites, the Midianites, Abimelech himself, the Ammonites, the Philistines, how many years they oppressed them, who the deliverer was, and then how many years of peace? Every time I read or study the book of Judges, I am amazed at how long God gave them peace. Because they're just cycling. And yet, God in His mercy, in His grace, gives them a lot of years of peace so that there isn't somebody bugging them. 40 years of peace, 80 years of peace, shorter periods of time during the Ammonite cycle, but long periods of peace. God is a God of mercy, even when He's holding us accountable. Now, what was a judge? A judge was a regional ruler. They don't have a king. If you went to, if you went to Egypt, there was a king. The king was known as Pharaoh. If you went to one of the surrounding countries during this time period, they had a king. They had a single ruler. He was in charge of the army. They would conscript a large number of men into that army. They would make certain that the whole country that they were responsible for was under that ruler, that there was care and concern on a large scale. Not so with Israel. Israel has little regional rulers, and in fact, some of these guys overlap a little bit in terms of time. They are not over all of Israel. If you go back to chapter or to page 7 and look at Israel, there are little pockets of rulers. It's not one guy who's ruling all of this territory. In fact, over that period of 350 years, there's 17 of them, and they're responsible for a smaller area. God uses them to throw off the yoke or the oppression of a regional bad guy. And then this judge also does some adjudicating in his area as well. One of the things that's interesting about the outline of the book of Judges is it really falls into three groups. There's deterioration. I'm on the page 4, by the way. There's deliverance, and then there's depravity. A deterioration, Israel's failure to complete the conquest. If they had gone ahead and not stopped at 3 campaigns, maybe it would have been 30 campaigns, I don't know. But if they had completed the conquest, they would have had peace for a much longer period of time. There wouldn't have been the intermarrying. There wouldn't be the Ashtaroths and the Baals. They would have taken care of all that, but they didn't. Often I do the same thing. God identifies an area of my life, and I take care of a little bit of it. I'm not ready to, sell all the way out and take care of the whole thing. And that's the illustration of what happens in the book of Judges. I put a little note in there to try to indicate to those of you that love to do studying that it is really hard to do the chronology of the book of Judges. First off, because they overlap, and secondly, because it doesn't match up exactly in the time frame. I said about 350 years. One of the notes I put on there is it could be somewhere between 335 years to 410 years, depending on which scholar you want to pick. Now, on the right-hand side there, I've got some boxes, because here's the stories that you might know, and the whole point of our study this year is to try to identify where these stories fit. So the first one is the story of Deborah. If you have girls, this is a great book. It's a great book to teach the boys as well, but I'm just giving you highlights of things you could do at your dinner table. But the story of Deborah's victory, if you will, it's in the book of Judges, chapters 4 and 5, I believe. Yeah. 4 and 5. She is a regional ruler, very uncharacteristic of this culture that a woman would be chosen as the ruler. Interestingly, she is described in verse 4 of chapter 4 as a prophetess. There are no other female prophetesses at this time period. This is an astonishing acclamation of this woman. She is married, and she is a ruler. She's a judge. She's sitting under a certain tree. It's a place that people would know about in that region. And they brought their problems to her, and she adjudicated them. Judge Judy, only Judge Deborah. When things go bad, and it's time for them, somebody to step up and take on the enemy, the Canaanites, it's Deborah. And she looks to a military man. She asks Barak to help her or to be part of the solution. She promises him if he'll jump out there in the front and be a hero, that he can be the one that we'll cheer about at the end. And if he isn't, and she's the one that has to have the battle plan, then he doesn't get the glory. He's subservient to Deborah in the great and unbelievable victory. And it is a great story to tell about how she does the victory. Her story is well known in Sunday school ranks. The next one we might know a lot about is in chapter 6. Starts in chapter 6 and goes on into 7 and beyond. It's the guy Gideon. Everybody knows something about Gideon's fleece. If you looked at chapter 6 and start with about maybe verse 36, Gideon's being called upon to be a judge, to be a leader, a military leader. And Gideon says to the Lord, "If thou wilt deliver Israel through me, as you have spoken, behold, here's my plan. I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. if there is dew on the fleece only and it's dry on the ground, then I will know that you're going to deliver Israel through me. Okay. verse 38, and it was so. Okay, now dew on a select little spot, no dew around it. Is that a miracle? Sure it is. He should have been going, whoa, I'm glad I didn't get zapped by, you know, tempting God, but he did it, and it's done, and I know, and so that's what I'm supposed to do, and yep, and here we go. When he arose early the next morning, and he squeezed out the fleece, he drained the dew from the dew from the fleece, a bowl full of water. And then Gideon says to God, round two, do not let thine anger burn against me. Please, please, don't be mad that I may speak once more, but please let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, and let there be dew on all the ground. Now, you know, if you were the Lord, what would you have said to him? Enough already. Whap, whap. Stop it with the little testing thing. But, you know, God did so that night, for it was dry only on the fleece, and dew was all on the ground. It is a great story of Gideon wanting to make sure that he had God behind him before he took on this unbelievable task. Another story that you would know that would appear on this particular timeline is Gideon's army. And as you get into chapter 7, he starts off with 32,000 men. It gets reduced to 10,000 men. Then it gets reduced again to 300 men. And the great victory that is theirs is accomplished by only 300 men. Another very powerful story in Judges chapter 7. If we were going to go to one more Sunday school story, it would be the story about Samson and his hair. So if you flipped over towards the end of the book of Joshua, chapter 20, I think it is, Joshua 20, you got the story of Samson and his hair. Now, I would say to you, before you start teaching that, you ought to have some details about why Samson found himself in his predicament. What is Samson's big problem? And again, if you have boys, what a great character study and what not to be like in the judge of Samson. And God letting him have his hair long, probably a Nazirite. We discussed that before. He didn't have a razor touch his hair. And one of the women in his life wants to know where his power is, and that whole story around the cutting of his hair. The last part of the book of Judges is all downhill. Things are not going well. The story of Samson is not a story of tremendous victory, even though God gives him a measure of victory at the end of his life. It ends on a kind of a low note. And then we get the little story of the book of Ruth. Four little chapters, kind of an interesting book. It makes better sense when you know this little fact. And the fact is that it covers a period of time of about 30 years, but it's during the time period of the judges. So Ruth fits in the time period of the judges. If Ruth was a story that appeared in the middle of the book of Judges, it would make better sense to us. If it just took those four chapters and went in, I don't know, about chapter 17 or something and dumped it in, and then you read the story of Ruth, it would make better sense to you. Because when it stands on its own, it doesn't carry the impact of what's really being taught here. It's located not in Israel or not in Canaan where they're settling in, but it happens in the country of Moab. If you looked at a map in the back of your Bible, you found the Dead Sea. To the right, to the southern end of the Dead Sea, is the Moab area. And then below Moab is Edom. Moab is named because of the indiscretion that occurs between Lot and his two daughters. In Genesis chapter 19, Lot has sex with his two daughters. One of his sons, via his daughter, is named Moab, and the other one is named Amnon, both of whom become enemies of Israel. And the region of Moab is not part of where Israel was supposed to be. So Ruth and her family find themselves in Moab because there is a great famine in the land, and they're seeking a place where they can live. Rather than seek the face of God and have God meet their needs, they're moving to try to find a place where there's either more water or more available land that can be planted and so forth to sustain them. Because they're where they're not supposed to be, some things start happening in their lives that are not great. husband dies off, two sons die off, and the mother, Ruth, is ready to come back. She gets, I guess, the picture that they shouldn't have moved to Moab in the first place. She wants to move back, and it's the story of her two daughters-in-law. Most of you know one particular verse in chapter 1. Let's see, verse 16, because you hear it at weddings a lot. But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to go back or to turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God." Ruth is the daughter-in-law I misspoke a moment ago. My point is that when she's speaking to her mother-in-law, those are the words she's saying to her mother-in-law, not to her husband. But we find it in our culture in the context of weddings a lot. The point is that Ruth says to her mother-in-law, "If you're going back, I'm going with you. I'm leaving behind the false worship of the gods that would have been a part of Moab, and I'm going into Canaan. I'm going back to where we're supposed to be. I'm going to take on not only the culture, the family, but the worship that's consistent with you." And so Naomi goes back with Ruth. They actually land in the city of Bethlehem. And the first part of the book is takes place as Ruth is gleaning out in the field. That's how they took care of the poor. And back then, they did not have Medicare and Medi-Cal and Meta-something. They had a provision. God would say, if this was your fields, you can come and glean or get all the fruit or the wheat or whatever it is you grew on the center section. But on the edges, don't harvest it. Leave the edges. And the poor in the community will come and they'll harvest the edges, and that's how they'll be taken care of. And Ruth, when she returns with Naomi, they are dirt poor, and so Naomi sends Ruth out to glean. She's gleaning in a field of a guy by the name of Boaz, and a great love story ensues. What's fascinating about the love story, though, is the picture of what we call a goel, G-O-E-L. And in Deuteronomy chapter 25, one of the provisions of the law was that if a husband died, a member of his family, one of his brothers, were required to be a redeemer kinsman. Kinsman meaning part of the family, redeemer meaning step to the plate. And so what that kinsman would have to do was he would be willing to step to the plate, pay off any debt that part of the family had, marry the widow, raise her children, his brother's children, as his own, so that the family line could continue and there would be no loss of the family. And the great and wonderful, powerful story is that the actual child that's born to Ruth and Boaz, let's go to chapter 4, verse 16. Naomi, the grandma, takes up the child and lays him in her lap and became his nurse. The neighbor woman gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." So they named him Obed. Obed is the father of Jesse. Jesse is the father of David. So we have the Davidic line, which was promised, of course, starting with Abraham, rehearsed with Isaac and Jacob, and now going to be shown through one of these little stories in the middle of the time period of the book of Judges. And for those of us who know our New Testament, we know that Christ is described as our Goel. If you looked in 1 Peter 1 and in Hebrews chapter 10, we hear all the truth about God's being willing, being one of us, coming in flesh, being willing as one of our kinsmen to offer himself, to redeem, to buy back, to pay the price so that we remain or become part of God's family. It's a great story, and it's certainly pictured in the New Testament. At the end of each one of our lessons, I'm asking myself the question, so what? This is a history book or books. They record what I called selective portions of the historical account. But why were they written? They certainly weren't comprehensive. They didn't tell us everything. Why did God want to tell us about the conquest? Why the story of Jericho and the other cities and areas that were conquered? Why that focus? And it's very clear in understanding that the purpose of those stories is so you and I are focused on a life ruled by faith. They had victory because they trusted God. You and I have victory exactly the same way. If you trust in anything else, I had to laugh when a year ago when the 401ks were particularly bad, You know, everybody was having a fit. Every month when the reports would come, the conversation in the teacher's lounge or somewhere else, well, I'm down 3%, I'm down 5%, I'm down 10%. You know, okay, is your trust in your 401k? That would be pretty dumb. Even though we're having a little resurgence and the numbers are better, what happens if it goes back down again tomorrow? If your confidence is in the value of your home, hello? Anybody glanced lately? Taxes are going up, values going down. You know, is your confidence in your spouse? Scary. Is your confidence in your kids? You know, they go south too. Where is your confidence? And the point is, our confidence cannot be in our jobs, in our savings, in our homes, in our health. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar declared that he's had leukemia for a year. You know, he looks like a specimen of health, and he has a raging case of leukemia. You put your confidence in your health? I'm strong, I'm virile, I'm healthy. Well, that's today. What about tomorrow? You know, and I thought of Psalm 33. I have this psalm on my desk, on a little card, and I read it with great regularity. Psalm 33, verses 16, 17, and 18. It says, no king is saved by the size of his army. No warrior escapes by his great strength. A horse is a vain hope for deliverance. Despite all his strength, he cannot save. But the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear him, on those whose hope is on his unfailing love. My confidence is not in my savings or my home or my relationships or my health or where I live or my job. My confidence is supposed to be in his unfailing love. It's the story for you and I right out of the book of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. Let's pray together. Lord, we do thank you for these Old Testament books that perhaps at first glance just look like old stories, but they are so real. You could just change the names, change the location, change the details of the culture, and it sounds like us. It sounds like South County. It sounds like the 21st century. We are no different than those people. And yet, what an illustration you gave us in the theocratic books, that you're supposed to be the ruler. And when you are, things are right. When we choose you to provide the victory in your way, in your time, with your circumstances in mind, that's the step of living by faith, rather than trying to maneuver it ourselves. I pray that we would apply this individually this week. And I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.